Welcome to Tell Me What You're Working On, where I speak to creatives in our community about what they do, how they do it, and why they do it. Born in England, where he learned from master craftsmen, award-winning silversmith and jeweller Philip Noakes has had an extraordinary career. He's a passionate maker who came to Australia and found an abundance of new opportunities. He's done everything from high-profile commissions, jewellery, exhibitions, fashion and film costume, to running his own workshop and studio, and so much in between. He tells us all about it, as well as what it's really like to put together an exhibition, and why he's keen to pass on his skills and knowledge in the tradition of those craftsmen before him. What an interesting person. Enjoy his story. Hello, Philip. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to come and chat with you.
Let's start at the beginning. You work with metal, essentially, in a variety of ways and have a very broad range of skills that you've developed over your years. Were you artistic as a child?
I think I probably might have been. It's always hard to say, but one reference point is I was happiest in the art room at school, even though the school I attended was an engineering school. Perhaps that was the career I was expected to lead. But that didn't happen. And I'm a silversmith, goldsmith and jeweller now. And hopefully I can explain how that happened and started.
Yeah, I'm really curious. So engineering was a pathway that you were sort of steered toward. What changed it? And did you have the support of your parents to go and pursue something on a more creative level?
Sure. Well, I can tell you exactly when I knew something wasn't right. We went to a large factory in Coventry when I was a schoolboy, about 15 years of age. And when I got there, it was covered with oil and men cutting and grinding. And we were taken round and then into the drafting offices. And all I can remember is going home to my parents and saying, this is not for me. So a new pathway was discovered, which was via Goldsmiths Hall, because my mother made some phone calls, and we got in touch with using metal in different ways, jewellery and shaping and forming metal into objects. And of course, in England, there's a very large industry of silversmiths via Goldsmiths Hall in London, and also now up in Birmingham and Edinburgh at one time. And Glasgow. So I got introduced into a totally different way of using not just my hands, but also my aesthetics, which really came from the art department at school. We did make one piece, which was a candlestick out of brass and copper, which I still have. And it, for me, it was just this turning point of getting into a different career. And you must remember, this is around 1967, 68. And in London, the whole cultural landscape of England was changing with pop music and fashion and painting and also metalwork and interiors coming in from Scandinavia. For me, growing up in a Victorian house and then seeing these very beautiful light homes with soft and smooth finishes, I could see that there was something I would really like to engage with. That's how it started.
And so how long was your apprenticeship? Tell me a bit about
that. Well, I studied at Sir John Cass College, which was 5 years. It wasn't such a traditional apprenticeship, because an apprenticeship means being indentured to one maker. But at the college, we were subjected to high-quality craftsmen teaching us all the technical aspects, as well as doing sculpture and design and rendering drawings. That's using paints and pencils. And the Royal College of Art was involved with us. And it was a time of a great exploration into design and skill-based projects as well. It's fundamental that we have a skill set before we can really start to bring our aesthetics to the forefront. And that's what I've hopefully tried to do all my career.
When you started your training, was it with the intention of this is something that I think I will enjoy, or was there also this awareness of career options, and at the time, what would they have been?
Okay, well, I remember seeing an exhibition when I was at college by one of my favourite Scandinavian designers called Henning Koppel. And the exhibition was at Goldsmiths Hall. And when I saw it, I was just overwhelmed with the beauty of his work. And I knew exactly then, again, that I had to become a silversmith. It was just in me. And it's driven me all my life. We're all trying to create a thing of high quality, skill making, plus a beautiful aesthetic. My work, I still try and make beautiful objects, and that has a sense of history to the work and some other things that we might chat about later. But it was in this early time at Sir John Cass College, being immersed in this great silversmithing career that I'd see other people having, that I just knew. It's very hard to describe, but I just knew it's what I wanted to do. And I love drawing and painting and all sorts of things. So it's led me to quite a diverse career. Firstly in London, working with a couple of silversmiths, and then someone that was really important to my life, a maker called Louis Osman. And it's interesting, I was being trained as an engineer. He was an architect. Later in my career, I worked with another architect that turned to jewellery and silversmithing. So there's various ways in. And some of the very famous English jewellers were engineers beforehand. Andrew Greimer, one that is especially famous and made all sorts of things for the royal family, and also brought a new concept and aesthetics to late 60s and early 70s jewellery. So we were breaking away from perhaps more traditional ways of making. New technologies were coming in, and also an individual aesthetic. We worked under our own names rather than a big company name. We wanted to express our own feelings in the work and hopefully be recognised for it.
It sounds like a very fertile ground for creativity, because to think of sort of going into that field can sound quite specific. So it's interesting how you're talking about essentially where your creativity took you within that medium.
It can be specific to one little area, but I was watching students at the Royal College and at other art schools making all sorts of things like spectacle frames, things, corporate gifts for councils, all sorts of things, wrought iron gates. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a bowl or a gift or a trophy. It can lead into all areas. I've worked in a little bit in the film world, the fashion world. Also, contextually, when Australia was starting to push its name further in the world, like Koala Blue and those sorts of things.
I remember that.
Which was Olivia Newton-John's shop. It just led to all sorts of different career paths. But of course, for me, the greatest way to go is to deal with and make for clients. You get a full circle. You have an idea, they respond to it, you make it, and hopefully they love it. And it stays in the family forever.
Absolutely. So when you finished your training, what was the first step for you professionally?
The very first step was knocking dents out of hotel plate for 3 months at a workshop in London.
Okay.
And I remember the old boys, which they were at the time in the silversmithing area, hammering out dents. And in those days, health and safety wasn't really high on the agenda and they were all deaf. So it gave me an insight. Again, I thought, no, this is not quite right for me. So I started to push further out with my own ideas. So it was a great learning experience there. I mean, I knew nothing about business, and I'm not sure I still do, but that's not what drives me. The work drives me. I'm always thinking about the next new piece. But London was very important because I could see the most beautiful work being made for all sorts of things. I mean, there's lots and lots of silversmiths there, and also across Europe. So I had easy access to it all. Just an example of that, I've never gone to an interview for a job. I've always been asked, which is quite flattering, really. And that was just one of those really exciting things that happened, understanding that people were interested in what I do.
So how many years were you working in England before you made your way out to Australia?
3.5, 4 years.
Okay.
And that's where I worked before I came with Louis Osman, as I said earlier, an architect. But he worked on huge commissions for churches and universities and cathedrals. And his greatest piece, of course, is the investiture crown for Prince Charles when he was inaugurated as the Prince of Wales at Carnarvon Castle. It was made just before I was there, but it showed me that these pieces that you might be involved with have a historical and timeline link. And I found that quite satisfying. And I did realise at the time that the work I make will be around a lot longer than me. So I will have left my little mark on the planet. And that's actually quite nice to know.
Absolutely. And, you know, those items are so significant historically. I completely understand. So then what brought you out to Australia?
Well, I had a small workshop in London, very small, with another silversmith friend of mine from college. And I just thought, I need to go away for a little while, just travel a little bit. And I had a brother in Australia as a geologist. And he said, why don't you come out here and I'll show you around where the minerals come from. So I said, okay. But when I got here, I was offered a job making silver candelabra within a week. I couldn't believe it. And 6 months trip has ended up being over 40 years now. But one of the great things I found in Australia, it was highly encouraging of me and it allowed me to try out things. I had my first little exhibition in 1977 in Subiaco. I was asked to show. Now, this could have taken decades in the UK, but I have to be honest here. The salary was three times the amount that I was getting in England. So there was a great sense that makers needed to come into Australia. All the makers I knew at that particular time were all coming in from elsewhere, Europe, America and England, jewellers, ceramicists, painters, all sorts of people. And they were encouraged to come to show West Australians and across Australia what was going on and inform people that were interested and do teaching and those sorts of things. So it was a very different time. I suppose a lot's due to Gough Whitlam's increased finances in the arts area, which has left us all in good stead.
Yeah. What was it like preparing for that first exhibition?
Nerve-wracking. Because when you have an exhibition, you actually put your soul out there with the work. And even if you sold every piece and you got great reviews, there was always something else you would have liked to have shown.
Yeah.
So there's a great link between exhibition work and being validated for what you do. One gets over that the more you do it. And it's probably just as well. But it's great fun to listen to people look at the work and see how they feel about it.
Yeah.
But the thing I've found more than anything else, especially with the larger objects I make, is that people are really interested in the work, which I didn't think they might be.
Okay.
And from all walks of life, that's why I've enjoyed teaching a great deal throughout my career.
Do you find that, obviously things have changed and we'll talk about your more recent work, but do you find that, especially in those earlier years, an exhibition was an opportunity to really exercise your creative ideas?
Absolutely. You have to try and create a body of work that's coherent, cohesive, and has some, if you like, aesthetic overview of the exhibition. And that's quite demanding. Mm-hmm. So what it does, it makes you think, draw, look, all these essentials in the fundamental processes of being creative. I try and use my own ideas rather than referencing other people's work. Occasionally there is other people's references to what I do, because you can't help be influenced by other makers. And I've always found exhibitions very demanding, because I would like to show new work and not rely on old ideas. And that's part of this creative process right the way through the 50 years I've been making.
And when you get to the exhibition point, are you usually satisfied?
I think if I was satisfied, I'd stop making.
Are you 60% satisfied?
No, much more than that. Oh, I'm actually very proud of the things I've made, and the reaction, which is really from the reactions I get about the work. Of course I'm pleased with what I do, but we're always thinking about the next piece. It's just part of the creative process. I mean, why do we need to make a bowl? A utensil for putting something in, or putting flowers in, say, or carrying water? Well, we do it because we're after the perfect shape or the perfect idea. And that never happens. It's like the chair. Why do we design so many chairs? Is there any need? Well, of course there is. It's called the human condition. And we're trying to make things using the creative process. And that idea of designing and drawing and creativity is fundamental to human existence and culture.
Yeah. And do you find also when you're exploring new ideas that there is also then the tension between the idea but then also the material?
Absolutely. It's a combination of all sorts of ideas, how the material will react to a drawing that I've done. Sometimes the metal tells me what it's going to do. There's an expression as a silversmith, the metal speaks to you when you're making. And my making is generally done with hammers. Yes. So I'm forming an object using a hammer, perhaps like a blacksmith's forges metal. And sometimes it gives up the ghosts and splits. And then there's words said. but that's part of the, not so much struggle for me now, because I'm quite used to shaping the metal. But it still gives me a great sense of satisfaction that my eyes and hands can create those shapes. And I don't use a lot of very contemporary technology at the moment. I much prefer just to use my hands and eyes, a little bit like the arts and crafts movement.
Yeah.
For me, it's more satisfying because I'm not making things too in a business where I would make lots and lots of multiples using high technology to keep costs low and everything exactly the same. I'm working as an artist craftsman.
Let's talk a little bit about when you were in the Eastern States. That was a very prolific time for you.
It was indeed. I had my first gallery and workshop over there with a partner at the time, where we showed young Australian makers, and it was beginning of the 80s, which was an explosion in all sorts of costume jewellery, precious metal jewellery, and we had a gallery where we showed, if you like, contextually very modern work, contemporary work. And that was really exciting because at the time we were one of, I think, two or three shops and businesses doing that sort of thing. And it was called Studio Noco, and it was in Double Bay. And we had a wonderful reaction to the work. We did things for the Mardi Gras, big fashion pieces, things for Neiman Marcus in America. As I said earlier, Olivia Newton-John in Koala Blue. And again, that opened up another area. There was a fashion label called Covers with Barry and Marilyn Tafts that we did a collection of work based on their clothes with myself, but also about 10 other young makers that had been through the art training and schools here at the time. And those collaborations were really great fun because it gave me a different aspect. It made me meet other craftspeople. We discuss work. So that was really exciting. And we did end up there with clients that would say, Philip, just make me something. Wonderful. And that was really a nice thing to achieve. So we always, as they say now, push the boundaries a bit. But we never had anything turned down. So it's really exciting. They've all been exciting times. And also there, I did a little bit of work for the film industry, making film props, talons for Claws for Captain Midnight and tie pins for Christopher Lee. And I did a shield shape for Farlap, the movie. So that's something I never thought I'd do. So as they say, these days, one door shuts and another one opens. And that's quite exciting. And so I just follow my nose from time to time, but there's always a goal that I've had in my life, which is when I come closer to the end of my career, I can make what I want to do all the time, if possible.
Okay.
But I still enjoy the teaching as well.
Well, and we'll get on to that in just a minute. But that's what that was one of the things that I wanted to ask you in terms of, no, not necessarily a set career path. You had this incredible set of skills that you learned and you've continued to develop, but it sounds like the variety and the opportunities that have come your way have driven where you've gone, which I think is a wonderful pathway to be able to follow as a creative person, and it's continued to develop you and put you in the position, as you refer to in your later career.
Yeah, I think that's just having a broad scope of what I can do, but also the enthusiasm just to try new things out. It doesn't always work, but I'm quite used to doing that now. And that was part of why I started teaching. I just thought I'd try it out.
And I guess there's a confidence in, as you sort of go on through your work, I've discussed this with other creatives in terms of just that sense of knowing that you're going to get where you want to go, or it's going to come, or it's going to happen. Because I think that confidence in your creativity is something that continues to develop, and it's not really there at the beginning. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, students say to me, where'd you get your ideas from? And ever since I've been at college, I've never had, if you like, writer's block.
Yes.
There's always another piece in my head, but it's a constant. I'm always drawing or scribbling. You know, I go to a cafe for a cup of coffee and I'm scribbling all over the napkins there. It's just part of what I do, and tickets and all sorts of things. But in other words, I'm constantly thinking about it.
Yep.
I know that might sound boring for some people. It just naturally, that process of doing it is really very interesting for me.
So do you think that it comes from trying to solve a problem, explore an idea, or what's the other one that people typically say? Because there's usually a few sort of strands that people go down with their creativity.
I think you're probably right. I mean, I do try and solve problems with perhaps the technical aspects, which is easy to understand. Can I make this nicely? But also, it's not so much a problem, but it's working out the aesthetics of the idea. That's the difficult part. Because it's, as I said earlier, it's very easy to rely on past experiences. It's much more challenging and for me exciting trying to develop some new aesthetics or ideas in the latest body of work. And that has always been a constant. Even though when I look right back at my very first commission that I did whilst I was at college, I still think it's wonderful. And that was a chalice for a church. But then, of course, when you get those sorts of commissions, the briefs are fairly strict. And also there's financial constraints on it. I mean, just at the moment I'm doing a large three pieces for the new Chevron building in town, which are just sculptural objects. They're not functional, but I think they're really exciting. And that, again, is another new development in the work.
And did you have the freedom to come up with the concept?
Well, I did indeed. And they did see some what we call maquettes, models of some work I was about to make. And they liked them. They just wanted them scaled up for their building, which was really a nice opportunity. An American company investing in, I know there's four others, West Australians, that are involved in the work, and that's really important to get some recognition, some financial reward from companies that are extremely wealthy and can afford to do this sort of thing. This is what happens in England.
Right.
The church putting money into work and all sorts of things, bequests and grants. And we do need those sorts of things to create this sort of cultural activity. It's very difficult for young people with the costs now to start careers like this on their own. It's one of the things here that there's a lot of discussion about, education of it all, and where the crafts and arts might go.
Well, that's the question, isn't it, yeah, with the demise of so many training programs and courses.
So I do my little bit by teaching in my own studio, which we set up about 10 years ago with a jeweller called Claire Townsend, but she's left now, and I'm running it with my partner on our own. We do have some other teachers, but what amazes me is the response to doing very simple jewellery classes initially. And over the years, I've had students that have stayed with the workshop all the time, and they're making quite interesting and exciting work from people that have never been involved in the arts or crafts. I mean, we get a lot of retired architects, engineers that are used to sort of looking at things. But even after all these years, the hardest thing to do is get people to use the pencil and draw. I mean, they can write
the basics,
and they say, oh, Philip, I can't draw. Of course you can. Get the paper, mark it with a pencil, and you've started.
Yeah.
Drawing for me is just takes me on that road to where the idea and the scale and the design of the object might come from. I prefer that sort of method rather than perhaps mimicking nature too much.
And don't you need a blueprint?
You do, but the blueprint, I suppose, is me. It's how it's developed.
Mm.
All those ideas that I've had, looking at things, architectural shapes, other people's work, the landscape, all sorts of things influence what I do,
yeah,
but I don't, if you like, set out to make a piece based on anything in particular.
Mm.
I use all those elements in the work. So with exhibition work, there's an overview on all the work at that particular time. There's a theme, perhaps,
yep,
that runs through it. The latest work has got these sort of wave shapes running through everything. But it's about the reflection of the surfaces, the scale, and that's sort of the way I work. I like to have part of it undiscovered.
Mm.
I like the sense I get a surprise when I'm making. And that might sound a little bit lame, but it's actually not, because the metal will do things that you're not expecting it to do. And that's exciting.
Well,
if everything was a formula that I knew exactly, yeah, what was going to happen, it'd be a little bit dull for me.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like cooking. You know, sometimes you get a fabulous meal, you do it the next time, it's dreadful. Why? Something's gone on, and I think I know what it is. It's the passion and drive and love of what you do. If you enjoy it, and silversmithing is highly meditative,
yeah,
so I can go in feeling a bit tense. But as soon as I start that, I can feel myself relaxing, because there's lots of hammer marks on the work, lots and lots. And the rotation of metal and using hammers, as I say, it's highly meditative.
And it's not a fast process.
No, very slow. one of the most famous pieces that I like by the designer I chatted about earlier, Henning Koppel, they estimate takes 550 hours to make.
Gosh.
So using your hands is never going to be fast.
Yeah.
And this is why we get students all around the world saying, this is not quick enough. So we go into mass production techniques. So we try and hold back. That's why, if you like, I'm old school now, where I want to use my hands. And if it takes time, it takes time. A painter doesn't do them in 30 minutes.
Do you think that attitude of fast and pace is going to have a long-term impact on where things go in the culture?
Well, I think it already has to a certain area. It depends how you use it. But what we do notice is that people that do some mass-produced work, they might have the idea and they get it made offshore, is eventually they come back to making what we call, jewellery-wise, and with silversmithing, one-off pieces or a collection, because it has, I think, more meaning.
And surely satisfaction for the maker.
Absolutely. I mean, you can do a 3D printed model and have it made somewhere else, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that, and it's important to keep costs down so people can enjoy the work that's being made. But there is a statement I do like to make: good design doesn't need to be expensive.
Mm-hmm.
It's the exploration of the ideas, which is really important. That's why arts education is absolutely essential. I mean, in my family, we've got a ceramicist, I'm a silversmith. So it's second nature. It's like having a family involved in music. It's just there. And then, of course, as you grow up, you go into wonderful museums all around the world and you see things that were made hundreds of years ago and you look at them and think, they're absolutely exquisite. How did they do all this?
Mm.
And it leads to a journey of the historical side of what I do. And it's always kept me, what do we say, amused? and alive, really.
So let's talk about your teaching. When did you start teaching?
Well, actually, about the first week I left college, we were asked by the Inner London Education Authority, would anyone like to do hobby classes?
Okay.
At schools for adults and for children, because they were desperate for teachers. Okay. So I did that for a year or two. And then mainly my teaching career has developed in Australia, teaching at some of the universities, Curtin, which was Waite at the time in Western Australia, Sydney College of the Arts in Sydney. And it's been a great eye-opener. Two reasons. One is that you'll meet people that you never thought you'd expect to meet. CEOs of companies, people with really high-powered jobs, people that have never done anything before, everybody. And I found I quite enjoyed doing it. In other words, I enjoyed imparting any knowledge that I had onto other people, and hopefully they might take my advice or not. But there's a reason for that. When I left college, we were in this historical timeline as a maker, silversmith. We were told that if you learn anything, you should pass it on to the next generation, because that's how the timeline of craftsmanship continues.
Yeah, lovely.
And in England, of course, we had these old guilds to keep things going. I think I've told you once before, the smallest guild in England that I knew about at college was the Spoonmakers Guild, and there were six of them. So there's all this sort of, if you like, Dickensian medieval pageantry all about the industry I'm in the UK. But in Australia, it's been fantastic. I mean, we have no problem finding people to come to classes. I think we've had a bit of a closed audience at the moment because no one's been able to travel. But we always full up from very beginning work to some actually extremely beautiful work, which really surprises me. And it's really encouraging for me to see people make things and the enjoyment they get. You can see it in their eyes. You can feel it in their demeanour. Philip, what do you think of this? And I look at it and think, oh, it's beautiful. There's a lot of tears and worries and things go wrong, but that's part of the whole thing. So, as I said earlier, this immediacy is not what's necessary. It's a slow learning path. And you either enjoy it or you don't.
What do you say to people who think that, who would say they're not creative?
Do a block of jewellery with me and come and meet people that have said this time after time and see what they're doing. If you can cook, you're creative.
Exactly. I find it really interesting.
If you can garden, you're creative.
Yes.
The first leap is joining something and meeting other people and drawing and doing something. We all made a clay ashtray at school and our grandma said were wonderful. Yes. And they might have been kind, but that's a creative process.
Absolutely.
We all wear fashion. Yeah. You think fashion designers do? They try and make us look fabulous all the time. So there you go. Everyone can be creative.
And so how long have you been running your studio now?
This one, 10 years. 10 years on and off.
Nice.
Yeah. I teach a couple of days a week and weekends from time to time. And I like it. It's tiring. It's exhausting teaching because when you have young students or students that are starting out, they want all your energy. So I go home and just really tired but quite exhilarated from it. And I will do it as long as I can. But I've had fabulous reception here, so why stop what's working?
Absolutely.
And people love it.
So the question of the podcast is, tell me what you're working on. So what is it that you're working on these days and what direction are you going in?
Okay, well, I'm working on a new exhibition, and it'd be the third one in 5 years, which is a lot of work.
Yeah.
And the work's going over to Melbourne, to Australian galleries, and I'm putting a collection of about 25 pieces together for this show next year. It might not sound like a lot of work, but I can assure you each show takes about 2 years to put together. And the work is, again, mainly vessel forms and with this wave sort of pattern running through it, which I mentioned earlier.
Yes.
And the scale's gone up, is slightly larger, and that's the confidence knowing I can work quite large. And the pieces I've made, I think, are working extremely well. Now, they're not all in silver. Some are in copper. So I'm trying out different materials. And I'm trying different shaping from previous shows. The surfaces of the work for this exhibition are highly reflective. And they show each individual hammer mark on the metal. And I spent 2 or 3 months doing drawings and little copper maquettes, some in cardboard, some in very thin copper, to give me an idea of the scale of the pieces. But it's an extension of the two previous shows. And at each show, I'd sort of talk about the processes of making them. As I've said, people seem to be very interested in all of that. Australian galleries has got a long, long history, and I'm really delighted to show there. And hopefully I'll get a good reception. Now, you asked about perhaps anxieties before shows. This is the first time I've had a big-ish show in Melbourne. So there's a timeline. I get anxious about that, getting enough work done, or paying, if you like, my dues or respect to the gallery that said, please show with me. I have been asked to show again here in Perth in 2014. People say, why do you show, Philip? Don't you have enough clients here? Well, an exhibition allows me to put a body of work together which clarifies my aesthetics at that particular time. And it's really gratifying and validating to see this body of work when it's on show. I think, gosh, have I done all this? Where's it come from?
And that's wonderful.
There it is. And then people might say, Philip, I love your work. Mm. Well, what more can you ask for?
That's the marvelling part, isn't it, really?
You know. There's always mystery to it. Yes. There has to be.
Yes.
I remember having a young boy ask me a question, how do you make these forms that you do? And I started talking about technical issues, and his eyes were glazing over, and I thought, no, this is no good. And I said, I hold the metal and I hit it and I rotate it. And after all these years, it's still a magical process.
Yep.
And it is, it's magic. That's why in early histories, early metal workers were trying to turn lead into gold and the alchemy and all those sorts of things.
And is that what keeps you engaged?
Yes, the mystery and the enjoyment. And the surprise of what happens when it's finished. is the piece finished? There's a restraint in my work, which I have always had. I'm more interested in the overall form. I don't want to lose it with all sorts of accessories on it or extra pieces on it. I want to keep a fundamental form that I might cut, hammer, or change, but I don't want highly decorative pieces. And that seems to me to be from my initial enthusiasm for this early Scandinavian work, which was such an influence when I was at college.
Looking back on the many things that you've done in your career, are there a couple of projects or items that really stick in your mind as favourites?
Well, there are. One's quite recent, and I still have them, and it's a pair of pineapples that I made in silver and gold. Why? I'm not sure why. But there is a little bit of a story to it, and that is that pineapples were very exotic and expensive when they first came into England. So the silversmiths started to copy these table decorations because they weren't eaten. And I just thought, it's time for me to make what we call follies.
Okay.
Things that are right off centre. Now, England's famous for its follies, buildings, things in gardens, memorials. So I've started making that. I've made some artichokes, and they're great fun to do.
So you're in your vegetable stage?
Yeah, the vegetable stage, because, you know, being an Englishman, I'm probably a frustrated grocer, having a shop like Margaret Thatcher. Anyway, and there's some other pieces of work that have been really exciting to do. In the UK, some big, big pieces. We made a set of water jugs for Liverpool University, which are extraordinary things to make. They weren't my design. I was working with Louis Osman at the time. And they were just very complex to do. And I realised then that objects that I make need time. Now, these jugs took 250 hours a piece to make. And I was quite surprised that I could actually do it. And again, another milestone reached. Don't be frightened of trying something. It might work, it might not, but it did. But there's been funny ones too. I've made goose quill cigarette holders, cigarette lighters and cigarette cases. One of them was made in England for a gentleman that used to send his chauffeur to have the lighter filled up with gas. I mean, what was his name? Liberace said, if you've got it, flaunt it.
Indeed.
When someone was looking at this opal ring when he was in the Russian tea rooms. But in Australia, what have I made that I really enjoy? Well, all the exhibitions that I've done, the collections in them, especially this new work I'm really excited about. I have to be honest, I really think after all these years, we're starting to get somewhere. Because it does take a long time. And it's not a rush.
Mm.
So I hope to use the last 10 years of my making career exploring all of that. So there's always a future. There's no retirement with what I do.
I was going to say, it sounds like you see an end point, but maybe more just a slowing down point.
We all know what the end point is, but no, not for a maker. You work within your abilities and means, and whilst I'm still able to do it, I will. I mean, painters that, you know, their eyes... They start losing their sight, paint differently. So I will perhaps have more wobbly work when I'm really old, but so be it.
Are you still making jewellery?
Yes, but not as much as I used to. I'm usually asked from time to time, but just at the moment I have no jewellery commissions to do. And I'm pleased about that because I've got a lot more work to do for the Melbourne show.
And do you have a lot of commissions lined up?
In the silversmithing, yes. Yeah. Enough to keep me going probably for 5 years.
Wow.
Because I have clients that say, the next piece that you do, can I see it? So they have first options. I've made silver handbags and silver dog collar with enamel on. These are all for clients in Western Australia. And they're waiting for new pieces. One of the clients saw some of the new work and he wants 6 of one of the pieces.
So you're really at a point where they're waiting for you as opposed to you waiting for people to come to you.
And that, I think, is the way of craftspeople, that you reach a point, hopefully, where your work is in demand. And then
absolutely,
they have to wait. There's nothing you can do about that. When I worked with Louis Osborne, we had 4 years of work always lined up. And there was an American enamelist called John Miller, where he made sea creatures, and he had enough work for the rest of his life. The next one was made, was shown to a client, do you like this one?
That's incredible.
So you're after the person's work, aesthetics, identity. So they're after the lifetime experience of the maker. And exactly, that was something I never thought about or would happen, but it has. Yep. And I'm very grateful for that. It's fantastic.
That's wonderful. Philip, if people want to see more of your work or find out more about you or the workshops, where do they go?
There's a website. Contemporary Metal has a website for the workshop. And then there's Philip Noakes' website. And they're always welcome to come to the studio and have a look round. We give little tours if people are interested. And, of course, the next big opportunity is Melbourne. But I do have a pre-show for Perth people where the work's just on the workshop benches so they can see what's going on.
Fantastic.
If they can't get to Melbourne. And hopefully we will all get to Melbourne.
Exactly.
But hopefully is the optional word there. I'm always very happy to show people around.
And you're also on Instagram, and on Instagram,
yeah, on Instagram,
there's some videos of Philip, and it gives a good example of the work and the labour involved in the work, especially in reference to some of the things that you've discussed with me today. Philip, it's been so fascinating talking to you. What an amazing set of stories that you have. Thank you so much.
I hope it's been interesting. So, sometimes craftspeople are more interested in working on their own, making their things. And chatting's not always their best ability, so I hope it's been enjoyable, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
You did pretty well. Thank you so much, Philip. All the best.
This project has been made with the support of the City of Stirling through their Community Creativity Fund.